So do you think that if we are to achieve peace, what role the state would play in the future? I'm not very skeptical that the state institution would facilitate it.
Would be the vehicle.
I'm quite skeptical. In fact, I think they would take it the other way. So what do you think?
I mean, what does the state signify here in the context of Pakistan right now? It clearly doesn't signify an institution for you that's capable of meditating on or ushering forth a landscape marked by peace.
Right. I think there's that element also that the state in Pakistan has been quite dysfunctional. But in general, I feel that states have their own, you know, national security interest, as you pointed out, in mind, that mostly is not achieving peace. Or historically, that hasn't happened. At least after the whole creation of a nation state in, you know, the last 200-300 years, I don't think that's... I'm cynical about that. So what do you think this is? I mean, I don't know, you know, the role to be played by the state in the future.
It's almost as if there is a rupture between the state and the people that the state is meant to be governing. Whether a government represents its people, whether a state is something transcendental. But the state seems to be operating independently of the people that it's supposed to be serving. So if you accept the premise that the state is working independently of the benefit and welfare of the people, then it seems difficult to imagine the state actually working towards fulfilling goals of peace that ultimately help people. But if you define it in terms of states achieving a peace amongst themselves, sacrificing the goodwill of the people, then I think maybe the state could be instrumental in that kind of a setup. But I don't think that's what the intuitive conception of peace is anyway.
But then again, you have the concept of citizenship, right? Where there's rights and responsibilities to and from the state. So in a lot of nation states, especially in the third world right now, the concept of citizenship is almost non-existent, specifically in Pakistan's case, where we're torn between nationalism, we're torn between what our intrinsic identity is. We have Islam, we have religion, we have patriotism, but we have no concept whatsoever of citizenship. There is no rights, there is no responsibilities. The state and the people are so far apart from one another. I mean, there used to be this concept of the state providing security. Even that doesn't exist in our context anymore. So you can't even, even if the state could play a role, very objectively, if nation states could play a role, quite a few places where this concept doesn't exist, I mean, you can't even come to that question. So maybe intrinsically, nation states or the way the system is, maybe they could look at, you know, coming up with something. But given the fact that there is no uniformity in terms of the way states are, the way they're formed, the way they're governed, the way they exist, we can't come to that question.
No, but if you approach the question in terms of the fact that creation of state, one of the reasons would be achievement of peace, mm-hmm. and if peace is understood more in terms of security, rather than some idealistic notion of everybody is, you know, in a very peaceful state. Maybe that can help explain it in terms of the fact that there are actors external to the state and you need protection against those, and there are internal rifts and everything and you need protection with that. So state is going to be central to that concept of security and protection.
So we go back to Hobbes and say, over all violent and we'll kill each other?
Yeah.
Rather than looking at Aristotle and going like eudaimonia, good life.
Yeah. See, it's not necessarily going back all the way to Hobbes, but what Maria is saying, what you're saying, fusing the board together, it's not really clear what is exactly external to the state and what exactly is internal to the state. As far as citizenship is concerned, in its concept, it's like forced obligation. The fact that you're born in a state means that you're a citizen of that state. It's not something that you naturally ascribe to. For example, we see freedom struggles in Pakistan. Would you classify these provinces fighting for autonomy as external to the state or as internal to the state? That is also a question in itself. These intrinsic battles happening within the state, whether another creation of a state itself is a challenge to the achievement of perpetual peace. Mm-hmm. Till when, where do we draw the line? If once we've created Pakistan or within Pakistan, if we have the other freedom struggles,
that's
whether those are external to the state or that is internal to the state. I don't say it's a question of citizenship.
That it is a question of citizenship, because at the end of the day, you don't have an intrinsic identity. right? Your identity, your ethnic identity, your
religious
identity, your
more
of
multiple
identities
rather than
just
in terms of citizenship, in terms of the state.
How would you?
There is none. That's what I'm saying. That's precisely what I'm saying.
Not just in Pakistan, like anywhere. How is an identity defined? Because kahin pe bhi, there are a lot of cross sections, whether religion, whether ethnicity, whether language. It's
that
a cross section of all those things which define an identity.
That identity comes through citizenship, right? Where you understand the fact that living in a certain nation state, the state owes me certain rights, I owe it certain duties and obligations, there's a set of rules we're supposed to follow, and it's through that that you develop an identity. This identity is based on citizenship, on the notion of rights and responsibilities.
Okay.
What in the case of Pakistan, this doesn't exist, see, because you have your ethnic identity, your religious identity, or whatever other identity, playing a far important role than the notion of citizenship.
But if you look at a country in which arguably there is a strong sense of citizenship, such as the United States, right? Arguably, what happens there is that, I mean, can you really see the state working for the well-being of its people? I mean, in terms of fulfilling these larger goals of peace, as in when it comes to the United States, and I mean, the Western European states, for that matter. So, for instance, you have the United States of America that's clearly not perpetuating peace when it's fighting these illegitimate wars, etc. And not just that, but even domestically, fighting these wars is not helping its people in the long run either, because it's antagonizing the rest of the world. So even in a country where you have this concrete sense of citizenship relative to the rest of the world, you don't see this nation state working towards fulfilling the goals of peace, however you define it. So I don't think citizenship is necessarily pivotal to the notion of peace.
No, maybe I think what Mariam is saying is that it's probably necessary in terms of the fact of internal peace, and she's probably linking to the fact that how in Pakistan you have multiple identities and there isn't belief in the state in itself,
yeah,
because of which they will threat the notion, they will challenge the notion of the state also.
Playing any role at all.
No, but the question is, does your citizenship in a sense cancels itself if your rights and responsibilities are not fulfilled? Because setting that as a criteria is a very, very slippery slope. It's very dangerous. For example, you cannot get rid of the fact that you're a Pakistani just because your rights have not been fulfilled. Whereas when you, it's not for you to decide as per legal obligations that from now on I'm not a part of Pakistan as a state and, you know, fight for another citizenship or fight for another state or fight for a freedom struggle. So what Mario was talking about, the internal and the external factors, it's really hazy there. Where do you draw the line?
So hasn't there been a movement to looking at peace beyond the state? I mean, that's the general... I mean, at least that's how the academics and the liberals argue in order to achieve peace, you have to sort of transcend beyond the state, the whole concept of human security it's like national security is seen as something which is important to the state, whereas human security, I mean, so the state is trying to sort of, look out for national security, and it's not the same thing as human security, whereas human security is looking at all the four generations, development and poverty and food security and all those things the state might not just provide because it might not be in its national interest, because the state is looking at national security, it does not see states or itself as an aggressor, whereas in human security, the state itself would also be an aggressor. Mm-hmm. And I think, going back to Maria's point, my question, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but don't you think, I mean, historically speaking, when states are trying to protect against other states, internal, I don't even want to, that's another debate, but they have done a really bad job, because you have time and time after again wars between states on the notion that they want to get to peace. Whereas, you always have these wars and, then they have these agreements, and it's happened over the last 300-400 years, and after every world war, there's, something happening, but then...
But I'm going to look at it from the other point of view, that all of the peace efforts have failed. Like, that's how I would look at it.
But even, sir, what you're talking about, the later criticisms sort of, falls back to right to the start. What you're talking about, human security, either as a universal world, you can guarantee human security, or you can guarantee state dominion. For example, if in a certain state there's a dictatorship and those human security rights are not being fulfilled, whether the world as an entity has a right to enter and provide that human security to those people. and then that leads to war, that's not peace itself. So how do you define peace and what exactly is your interest?
That's a good question, because when you're talking about human security, who provides you with that human security? State is diminished because state is just one other part, another party. And in fact, if it is not providing or it is taking away human security, then who acts against the state? I mean, then there's the whole notion of globalization and international actors, and then the fact that citizens themselves need to come together. So that was my question originally also. That, I mean, this just might be another,
within that framework, there is tension between human security and state sovereignty.
That's what
there
I
is national tension.
Right, because national security and human security also clash. Right?
They do.
So,
yeah.
For instance, if you redefine peace to be something beyond interstate peace, then it's almost like an implicit concession that it's probably difficult to achieve that sort of peace, and hence you have to look beyond that paradigm. But that like Shahzad was just saying, that just shows the implicit tension between states and the rest of the human population. It's because you are conceding the fact that we have to look towards other sources of peace, but the nation-state paradigm will remain even when you are looking beyond the nation-state. And so there will be that conflict between the people looking for a redefined peace, but the state that is constantly trying to maintain its dominance within the world. So I don't see how that would necessarily truly represent any sort of real-world peace at all.
I mean, Kant's text is interesting because it's marked by so many ironies, and he's conscious of them, I think. I mean, he, even in 1795, he knows there will be what he calls a state of nations, a United Nations, but he already knows it will fail because the nation states won't agree to abrogate their self-interest. Mm-hmm. So even if you had a group of nations that were internally at peace, you know, in every sense they were nation states that could enter into a treaty with another nation state, even then they would be so marked by self-interest that they would be unable to enact this vision of peace. And yet, we only have these nation states to work with in his vision.
But even it has come out with a judgment saying that the use of the nuclear weapons could potentially be legal if it is a threat to the existence of the state itself. Whereas you could use it against kill millions of people if it threatens the existence of a state, not its people, but the existence of the state. So I think that itself shows that there is self-interest involved. And it coming from the ICJ, it's been quite progressive, generally speaking. You know, you can look at the Israeli wall case and stuff like that. But in this particular judgment, in an advisory opinion, I wasn't very comfortable with that judgment. So I think that that's true. What you said.
I mean, Kant explicitly forbids any use of weaponry that cannot be apologized for, that leaves no possibility for peace in its wake. It's a fascinating part of his discourse. But so what about this idea of an everyday diplomacy? One of the people we filmed, Richard Sennett, I mean, I know that you've just been speaking to this in a way, but could you speak more to this notion? Is there a dignity to just the peace that would be the way that you relate to each other? Or is that too quickly turn into a relinquishing of any request on the part of the state to enact a world marked by peace? Is it too easy, in a way, to resort to the intimacy of everyday life? Or is that, in fact, the space that we should seek out as another space that can be a space of articulating peace?
Probably has more potential as compared to the nation-state paradigm. I mean, the nation-state paradigm itself exists in complete negation of one another. You're a nation-state, you're Pakistani because you're not American, you're American because you're not Indian, you're Indian because you're not whatever. So this would probably be a paradigm where you have a lot more potential to extract.
I think it's too easy and too difficult at the same time. I think it's too easy because you're sort of ignoring the actual problem and saying, you know, I'll just find solace in my home or my country or people. But I think it's too difficult at the same time because the problem is that the sense of insecurity has, at least for our country, seeped into the homes of ordinary citizens, and that we cannot really interact with people without thoughts of security or without thoughts of a larger sense or aspiration to peace. I don't think it's very easy to set aside the rest of the world and problems that are global in nature and just take solace at the home. I don't think that happens anymore, at least. I'm not sure, I can't speak for the entire nation, but at least, you know. I mean, there is no, I don't find a sense of peace
when I turn off the television and just sit at home. It's not that simple. And also I think it's very exclusive, because if you say that, you know, it's a global village and the human population can interact with one another diplomatically and that will lead to a sense of peace, well, you know, that's not necessarily true, because most people don't really interact with many people from across, you know, from different continents, and they don't really build these kinds of cultural bridges. It is very, I mean, it's happening, but it's happening in a very sort of limited sense, because you have countries full of people who really do not have that kind of global diplomatic interaction, and so their sense of peace, but then they don't get that peace that other people get. So I think that's almost, it's avoiding the larger question.
But the only thing I feel that the states are allowing, they are these artificial barriers. Like if you look at immigration laws in the last, you know, 30, 40 years, states have made it extremely hard to travel within, I mean, okay, maybe EU is an exception, but generally, for a Pakistani to go to America and take, I don't even think it's all about terrorism and all, it happened even before that. So states are trying to prevent that from happening. If it was to happen, don't you think that would actually improve their understanding and eventually lead to, it's like democracy, right? It doesn't work here, but if you give it a chance, maybe it will. So I don't know.
But that's, see, then we're back to the problem with the nation state again, sorry. But we keep doing that because ultimately that's what I'm saying, that it's exclusive. It excludes people because nation states exclude people, or because nation states set up these artificial barriers. So, you know, I think day-to-day interaction also very much is very much contingent on state policies and state-to-state interaction. So I think it's very difficult to isolate one from the other. So.
You can have interfaith dialogue, you can have intercultural dialogue, you can have all these things, but at the end of the day, does it really solve anything? What happens to the bigger political problems? What happens to the real stuff like transnationalism? Whereby people tend to associate certain political issues with communities, and which shouldn't be the way it is, but that is the way it is. And you find that increasingly in diasporas in the USA, in the UK, all around the world, whereby, for instance, all Muslims or all Jews would be, you know, identified with Israel or Pakistan or whatever. So how do you address these issues then? How do you erase all of that? I mean, there's so much that, you know, individual interaction can do. If it's really supposed to get somewhere productive, it needs to happen on a much larger scale. So how do you do that?
Are we understanding the concept of everyday diplomacy properly? Is there actually, is there something specific that you think of when you talk about everyday
diplomacy? I guess I was thinking of two things. On the one hand, I was thinking of one philosopher's remark, Richard Sennett, who was a student of Hannah Arendt. I'm thinking on the one hand of his remark of the importance of the way that we engage with one another, but then I'm also thinking of Kant's own notion of hospitality, which, for all of its problematic limitations, is something that really describes the way that one composes one's home, and that hospitality begins not in a governmental hall, but it begins in the home.
Like, I think they were understanding to mean to talking to the Indians or the Americans, that whereas it could be how we interact with one another in a daily context.
It seems that within Pakistan there's such also a similar kind of disunity, a lack of national cohesiveness or identity. There's more of a regionalism. Or a
yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that it's not as a nation state as France is, or it's definitely more heterogeneous.
In a sense, the question of everyday diplomacy has to kind of address this interaction, right? The dialectical between sort of how one acts, you know, in a classroom, which is already overstructured by its own legal regime, which is then within a larger political body of one sort or the other. I find this really generative and interesting. It's a question of what can one retain? Like, so what are the spaces of autonomy, if any, and are they desirable, that you can retain for defining sort of whether it's peace or just decency or dignity or kind of coexistence of some sort.
There's one thing I just want to mention, it's not directly connected to this, but I wish Rafi was here, he would articulate this better than I would, because I've got nothing to do with it whatsoever. But just the fact that, I mean, what I find interesting, since my job is with language, what I find interesting is that increasing disconnect between, you know, the elite articulate class of Pakistanis that you have here, and with everyone else. And there is, you know, this idea of everyday diplomacy. What I personally find is that all of these very articulate Pakistanis find it very difficult to communicate with people on the streets, for instance, and the general perception. And I mean, it also is partly a result of the fact that the way cities are designed and, you know, how our urban reality is and how it's been sort of further perpetuated, that you see that, you know, who gets priority, and that's increasingly also shaping our attitudes toward a vast majority of the people. So, for instance, people who don't have, who are from lower classes, it's increasingly difficult for the elite to interact with them, because there's this, I personally, my very personal observation, I find that there are no common rules between them. So the notions of fairness, for instance, is something so fundamental to any society. They are different. For instance, if you, I took a cab the other day. I called a cab, and the guy, you know, he was already charging a lot. He was charging about 700 rupees to go from here to Mal. I said, fine, you know, let's go. And we went there, and we got there. You know, he got lost in the middle because he did not know the way. And then when we got there, he said, you know, I'm going to charge you another 200 rupees. And, you know, so the idea is that, you know, I tried to appeal to the idea of fairness, but since there is no idea in operation, so it was difficult for me to interact with them, and how do I get out of that situation, you know? So, I mean, things like that, and it's sort of not just, you know, and I'd imagine that would also happen to other sort of, others in the society, and I think that's something that's not receiving as much attention from our people. And I think that's an important problem that's increasingly becoming exacerbating, and, you know, not getting enough attention.
I think it's not just classes within a city, but how you interact with people in the rural areas, and what notion of peace. Fairness is one thing, but even peace itself, what they perceive of peace is very different from what you perceive. In fact, if you're looking at the generic sort of, you know, like how citizens view themselves as, you know, like this whole notion of Pakistan, India, and how we view ourselves as Pakistani citizens, and the notion of peace or interaction with Indians and all. I think that the notion of how the rural person perceives that is very different. I mean, in fact, I'm talking from experience, because during the Kargil conflict, I was talking to some of my family members in the villages, and they really were not, they were more concerned about their own peace, internal peace, or for that matter, how in their own community they were surviving, rather than looking at these interstate issues. So I think that definitely it's not an informed picture if you're looking at people in the cities, or people like us who sort of view. I think it's better also to get their opinion also.
I think these personal relationships also emanate from the state. The whole idea of every man for himself is because of lack of resources in our country. For example, if you go to a Scandinavian country where HDI is much larger, much better than Pakistan, you'd see that once your basic necessities are fulfilled, at that stage you go for these conceptions of justice, of fairness. In Pakistan, due to lack of resources, it is a case of every man for himself, so everybody tries to squeeze out as much of the situation as they possibly can. And just the fact that in rural villages those necessities are not fulfilled, they are a primary concern for them, as opposed to international relationships or international laws or, you know, conceptions of justice or fairness. Well, my personal view is that it's not actually a lack of resources, but actually a weak state, right? It's a weak state. It's a state, you know, as someone mentioned, security has been outsourced now, right? I think that's the most fundamental sort of function of a state, to have monopoly of violence. And again, you know, to enforce peace, again, we're defining it in negative terms, but to enforce peace, you do need to monopolize violence and means of violence. But in Pakistan, what you increasingly see is that the state actually outsourcing security to, you know, each one, you know, you take care of your own security. And I think that, I think one of the main reasons why that idea of fairness is disintegrating is because there is no one to enforce any one idea of fairness, or any single authority that, you know, we could all appeal to, or could sort of settle matters of conflict. So anyone who's got a greater means of violence would just simply, you know, take the day.
But hasn't the existence of the state put more violence into play?
Sure, that too. But again, yes, I mean, I think that's one of the paradoxes of modernity itself, that you're increasing violence for more peace and increasing violence for more rights. So again, you know, we could also argue that, you know, you have more individual rights simply because your state has more peace and more violence, or the ability to exercise greater violence. So again,
well, the human security model challenges that and
okay.
says that, you know, it's a myth that states, by providing these sort of, you know, rights and security, they end up perpetuating other, you know, I mean, human security says state is the culprit in most cases, and you can achieve those things when citizens get together or through other sort of organization rather than the state itself, because it's just that, I don't know much about the philosophy of the state, but I think that the state, the mix-up is such that the sort of powers they do have, and they have, historically, they've not done a very good job, and I think that even, and it's an issue in both sort of states, when they're powerful enough or when they're too weak, anarchy seems to sort of creep up. So I mean, I'm not too convinced by the fact that it's an essential component of providing. And I think another question that I have really is this, I mean, you initially said that, you know, in America the talk is about primarily security, right? National security. So I mean, I don't know, don't they argue? I mean, I think, you know, I do feel that the assumption is that, you know, through security we also get peace, right? So this peace talk, I mean, it might be implicit, but the whole point is that, you know, freedom, peace, all of those things are interconnected. So I do think it plays a big part in Americans. I mean, the Iraq War was for security, or was it for getting, for achieving peace? I'm talking about how the normal average American perceives that also, right?
I think that, you know, generally speaking, my sense is that we've been conflating like two very different things, which is like internal, how states behave toward its own people, and how vis-a-vis how states behave internationally. And I think that that's a distinction that we need to maintain, you know, when we are sort of trying to talk about states' behavior and maintaining peace. I mean, states might do a great job, like for instance in the US, maintaining peace within their borders and enforcing rights and behaving, you know, in an accepted manner in terms of, you know, whatever the consensus is, but it won't behave. So for instance, if there is a secession movement within the states, it won't act in the same way as it acts in Iraq, for instance, or in the Afghanistan. It's just one thing for a state to act, you know, how is the state behaving.
So that's understandable, because laws related to how state governs itself within its own sort of territorial area, they made it more favorable towards them. I mean, if you look at the various covenants dealing with the two covenants, the ICCPR and the two covenants, one is the interstate conflict, one is the internal sort of. No, very few states have ratified the one which deals with their obligations to their own citizens. So, I mean, it's in their own interest to do that. So, actually, it has ended up in states killing more of their civilians and more of their own population, rather than, you know, this is casualties because of interstate. So that's actually supports the position that states are, you know, only protecting their own sort of entity. So I mean, I don't think that's a question.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a difference in degree, not in kind, in terms of how state behavior is within and outside its borders. Because I do feel that, well, everybody knows that, you know, a lot of states, I mean, have been built on the idea of violence. But beyond that too, I mean, currently, states do either maintain or promote divisions, or they, you know, purposely support two-party systems to make sure that there is this huge dichotomy of political belief, and I think that also contributes to them furthering their own self-interest. So I think there's a more blatant disregard for human freedom, maybe outside a state's own borders. Well, not a state's own borders, but outside the state's own entity and without its outside the country that it's supposed to be governing. But I think internally also it's interest to, in fact, to a certain extent, keep its people in line also. And that goes back to the idea initially that we discussed about the rupture between the state and the people that it's meant to be serving. And so I do think that it's a difference in degree, not in kind, in terms of the state's behavior.
I mean, if Pakistan, from what I'm hearing, is a weak state that's unable to provide for the security of a public that may not even see themselves as citizens, and unable to engage in peaceful relations, therefore, with others, India, let's say, wouldn't America be paradoxically a strong state that's in the same position? unable to be internally at peace, unable to be at peace with others? Like, what does America signify to you guys at this moment?
So it's a different stage. Maybe it's, you know, it's richer, maybe economically that is, it's different in that way. I mean, when something bad happens, like, you know, even in the U.S., there are issues like in, you know, during Katrina, or maybe in this Gulf oil spill issue.
I think the problems are just more exacerbated in Pakistan. What Aisha was talking about was spot on, how the state tries to perpetuate certain power structure. In the U.S., it's the white man who's on top of the power structure. So that structure has been perpetuating for a while. And
are you sure about that?
Yeah.
Black. Just saying, literally speaking.
Literally, the last thing the U.S. needed was a black man in the White House asking for change. But essentially, it's a certain power structure and a certain power dynamic. In Pakistan, it's even that upper class, which has looked after its own interests and which has had its role to play in state policy. So, I don't see the comparison just on that basis of how that is a strong state and how we are a weak state.
But I do think that there is a stronger notion of citizenship within the U.S. I mean, regardless of the fact that I do still stand by my words that the state does manage to perpetuate some sort of its own interest domestically as well, I do feel that there, at least amongst the American people, I mean, I'm an American citizen, he's an American citizen, and you know, we visit, and there is this, I mean, it's not very academic, but there is this sense of that people do have, as in they're cynical of government, but they're very, very, they're not cynical of the Americans, of the American state. The American state to them still represents certain ideals that it represented or was supposed to be representing hundreds of years ago or at its inception. So I think they've lost their faith in government, but not in the state. And so I feel that perhaps that lends to the strength of the American state. But that does not necessarily mean that the fact that the American state is strong will necessarily mean that it will contribute to some sort of global notion of peace, because that is ultimately what the point is. This discussion.
I think it's a matter of degree, really, because even in America right now, I agree with you that comparing it to Pakistan, yeah, but increasingly so, with a lot of poverty kicking in, people are quite skeptical of how, I mean, the notion, I mean, the state as providing them. I mean, I don't know, actually. I mean,
even in Pakistan, most people do agree with what the state is based on, or the ideals, or the words of the founding fathers, as per se. It's just how it's been dealt with, and the criticism of the governments, it's just that we haven't had good governance for a while, whereas it's better in the U.S.
No,
so it's also criticism of
governments
as opposed to...
I think in Pakistan, it's very difficult to pinpoint, okay, what does the state of Pakistan represent for you? People will probably say Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and that's it, right? They don't know what he even encapsulates as a figure, but it's basically, it's very difficult finding a common ground. But with America, it's the American dream, it's freedom, it's, well, open markets, free markets, capitalism, the individual over the collective, right? These are beliefs that you can pinpoint. Any American, I think, can pinpoint that this is what the American state is supposed to stand for. So even when, like in, okay, my reference point here is rap, okay? But even with rap music, right, when you have people criticizing, and it seems very, like, really radical criticisms that are targeted at the state or are targeted at governments, ultimately it's always, but the American state was supposed to provide this and it will provide this. So that, as in, not just rap, but academics too. Them too, yeah. But there is this sense that, you know, that the government, like I'm just repeating myself, that the government is failing, but that the state itself will, that it is aspiring or is meant to aspire towards something that is real and attainable. And in Pakistan, I don't think we have that goal, or we don't even know what that goal is. So I think that's what separates
Pakistan.
Right.
I mean, I think, on the other hand, I do feel that Americans, I mean, if you deal with Americans at different levels, I mean, it's very different what you rate. I mean, I agree with you, maybe to an extent, rap is indicative of American things, but actually, the way the movies are, the way the music is, if you actually talk to someone, like, let's say, who doesn't have health insurance, who, for instance, lives in, you know, South Chicago, and who's who can't, I mean, so his notion, we would not, I mean, I don't think he'd be as rosy as you point, you know.
I mean, is there something that you would associate peace with that may not be the nation state, it may not be how we've been defining it, but that would be something simple like the right to go for a walk through a public space that you may not feel comfortable doing here?
is this part of your public life, public sort of, you know, this public life out there? Are you like, that's something I also feel constrained by. I don't know if it's solely security issues, you know, it's like, you know, sidewalks and stuff like that also. The question is, would Pakistanis do, is there something customary about that also, that, you know, I've seen that in the Middle East, that they do that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, and in Europe there is this public life, and, you know, you walk, go to a cafe, sit down, take a walk. Why don't we do it as much? And maybe is it a class thing? I don't know. I mean, because if you ask a person, you know,
if it's about feeling comfortable walking in a place, I mean, you're going to get judged eventually for some reason or the other. If you're not looked at in terms of you being a female, you would probably be looked at as an Asian or a brown person or something or the other. There will be, it's intrinsic to us to otherize and to judge and to look at people and think something. So it really depends on what you feel comfortable being judged as.
It's not just about you being judged, okay? I'm a hardcore Pakistani, a hardcore Lahori. I am not comfortable in walking around the streets, mein. You know, she being a foreigner totally makes sense. But me, the Pakistani that I am, I can't go around walking in roads without feeling uncomfortable.
It's your gender that's limiting you. It's not just a security reason
that I'd get shot or I just... Your social classes, your culture, your heritage, everything stops you.
And yet, a few generations back, I mean, Salima Hashmi, who's my dean,
exactly,
will speak about going to school, going to college on a bicycle, and everybody did.
Happened with my mom.
And that wasn't just about safety on the road, I mean, it was something else.
Exactly. You know, for my mom, it was pretty normal walking to her school. If I today get up and tell my brother or my dad or whoever that I want to walk to my university, even though it's just 2 minutes away, they'd be like, are you crazy, out of your mind? You're not.
In a Buddhist philosophy, you know, walking is part of, you know, feeling peace, and there is something quite natural for humans to do, right? So, I mean, I'm trying to, you know, tie this to your work, but I do feel, because if you've had that experience, I mean, walk, you know, that's a part of it, right? I mean, it might be the public sphere of things that we're not really engaged with, within, you know, there's no interaction, and public life is missing in this country.
No, it's not just about a public life being missing. Walking for me is an expression of what you want to do, how you're comfortable, how you're peaceful, right? For an artist, it might be walking for someone else, it might just be standing somewhere or just lying down and everything, and we can't do that.
Or not having to lock your door, for instance.
Exactly.
So here, I mean, I don't know if everybody does this, but I certainly do. I live in a really, really safe part of Lahore, right here, somewhere nearby. And so, why did I tell you that? Okay, but... the point is that I would not feel comfortable keeping my door unlocked.
Of course, there's arguments that I have profound disagreement with. The way hospitality is limited, for instance, immediately. But at the same time, I really believe in this vision of cosmopolitanism, for instance, that he articulates. And as I read through the text, I read it not as a text from 1795, but I read it as a text that still speaks to the issues we work through today and think about today. And I really identify in a way with the text, despite its deficiencies and problems. Is that how you read it? Did you read it, what were you thinking as you read it? Did you think of it as a text that needs to be rewritten and updated for the present? Did you think of it as a text that could have been written today? Did you think of it as just a problematic kind of Eurocentric foundation for international law? How did it strike you?
I, in a way, sort of based on certain presuppositions, reading within Kant's framework and how you read about, you know, the moral obligations and what is enlightenment and how we should move into with enlightenment. Once we've achieved those things and how everybody acts morally and how being knowledgeable or being reasonable, following reason is moral. Once people are like that, this framework would work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very tricky presupposition even in that age. More so in our age, where people are much more skeptical about those things. In a sense, for a utopia, this could work. Practically, no.
I think there's a lot of foresight in, at least, I also, the entire cosmopolitan aspect of the work is interesting to me too, because he's working within the paradigm of the nation state, he's aspiring to something beyond that also at the same time, and he's looking at the human population as something that is not limited by territory or not limited by even culture or race. So I think that is ideal, but that is idealistic, but at the same time I think the aspiration is admirable for someone writing in the 1800s.
How is it 1700s? Not limited by territory? All he talks about is states.
Yeah, I know, but at the same time his aspiration seems to transcend the state.
He's trying to go for world peace and, you know, world structure, but in a sense it's defined by states.
But he is also at the same time providing for some sort of a framework. So if anything, it's idealistic, but at the same time it's not idealistic. I would argue people who are anti-nation state perhaps are even more idealistic than he is, because he still manages to look at what the looks at realpolitik and then tries to work towards idealism within that framework. And I think that's admirable.
I would say it's pretty much analogous to UN. It's sort of working towards that, what we've tried to work towards. It shows a lot of foresight in 1975. But 1795. But judging it in a postmodern setting, it fails as a practical framework. It's a great piece, but, you know, judging it practically, does it work?
I don't know, I'm extremely cynical about the concept of peace. It's well and good to talk about it when it comes to academia, and it's very easy to talk about it and ideas of peace. But from like personal examples, there was a bombing right down the block from my house, and I basically just woke up. Everyone asked me if I was alive and I went back to sleep. It doesn't really plague me every day that I need to achieve perpetual peace. I have conversations at home which talk about how the US is always going to be in this territory because they want to create an instability. It's like they've resolved to the fact and given up that there's never going to be peace in this area. And basically it's something that my mother says, my grandmother says, it's been around for that long. And I find that none of us are actually talking about it on an individual, everyday kind of level because we've just resigned to it the way that it is.
Yeah.